Okay, there in Daniel chapter 2, we're going to be changing. We've been going verse by verse, but I've not been too happy with the format there. So we're going to kind of look at verses in an area and then just discuss various things, themes, topics that are brought out in those verses. And we'll try that and we'll see how that goes. More like the format of the study that I've been doing when teaching on Wednesday night. So hopefully that'll allow us a little better format from our study. But there in Daniel chapter 2, Robert, would you read verses 24 through 30 for us, please?
Through 30?
Yes, sir.
Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. And he went and spoke to him as follows: Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows: I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered before the king and said, As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me, more than any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind.
Okay. A couple of observations I like to make, and all along the way, if there are questions or comments that anyone has, feel free to bring those to my attention, and we'll discuss those as a group. A couple observations I'd make from this section of passage here in Daniel chapter 2. It's contrasting the attitudes of Arioch, that is, the chief guard, and Daniel. Did you notice the statement that Arioch made? And did you know the attitude as he presented himself before the king? Kind of stood out to me how he spoke to King Nebuchadnezzar in contrast to Daniel whenever he speaks to the king in the manner and the attitude that he has. In verse 25, Arioch makes that statement there, and he doesn't have just a whole lot to say. But in verse 25, he says to King Nebuchadnezzar, and you almost hear it in his voice, I have found a man. You may remember the command King Nebuchadnezzar gave, go kill all of the wise men. And Arioch was the one that was in charge of that. He just happened to stumble upon one of the ones he was supposed to kill, and it was Daniel who said, oh, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. I can give the king the interpretation. Now, Arioch was just doing what he was told. But yet when it comes to standing before Nebuchadnezzar, he makes this claim, it almost sounds like he sought Daniel out. He found a man that would be able to interpret the king's dreams. And he says, I found this guy. I sense a little bit of pride there as Arioch speaking, because he didn't find this man. Daniel actually made known to him, I can tell you what the king's dream was. And if you contrast that with what Daniel says and the way that he speaks, he says in verse 28, there is a God in heaven. The conversation that he has with Nebuchadnezzar doesn't focus upon himself, but what he does is he brings him full circle back to God. You see humility, I believe, in Daniel's response. Think of the opportunity that lay before him. He's here and he's going to be essentially putting his life on the line whether he's able to make this interpretation or not. And as it happens, he's been given the interpretation and the dream by God. And verse 28, he says, there is a God in heaven. And he's standing before the most powerful king of the most powerful nation. And if he says, hey, I can interpret this dream from you, kind of like Arioch said, I found a man. What if Daniel were to say, I can interpret this dream for you? He's going to come out in very good standing with King Nebuchadnezzar, isn't he? Most powerful man of the most powerful empire at this time. Something none of your other wise men can do, King Nebuchadnezzar, I can do for you. But he doesn't do that. He doesn't refer to himself. In fact, he makes it a point to push away from himself and for Nebuchadnezzar to understand, it's not me. This isn't me in the least. He says, there's a God in heaven, Nebuchadnezzar. None of your wise men could do this, but there's a God in heaven. And it's not because, verse 30, it's not because I'm wiser or I'm greater or I'm favored by this God. Rather, it's because God wants to make this dream known. He's willing to provide the dream and its interpretation. And so you see him kind of disassociating himself from this interpretation, which is going to garner favor in the eyes of the king, while Arioch, You see him coming and saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, I found this guy that can give you the meaning of the dream. And so you see kind of a difference in the attitudes of those two men there in the text. And also, what we see Daniel doing is he's glorifying God here in this text. All of the ones who were brought before Nebuchadnezzar in an attempt to tell him what the dream was and then give him the dream's meaning. Verse 27, all the wise men, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, they couldn't do it. But then Daniel makes this statement, and the implications to this within the context, but not only within the context, within our life, there is a God in heaven. You consider that, but there is a God in heaven. And this God in heaven, Nebuchadnezzar, he can make known to you the dream and the significance of it and what it means. And so this conversation, it doesn't focus on himself. And he doesn't push himself up to the forefront as if he were the one that were giving this interpretation. He makes it known that it's God who is giving him this interpretation, and it's God who is providing the answer that Nebuchadnezzar is seeking. And you really can't overstate the importance of humility that I think we see Daniel here demonstrating. You think back to Numbers chapter 20, and you don't have to turn over there, it's just a reference. You think back to Numbers chapter 20, what was it? What action was it that kept Moses, who spoke to God face to face, out of the promised land?
Basically, his pride.
Yep. His pride. His disobedience and his pride. You know, God told him, speak to the rock. Moses struck the rock, and what did he say? Must we bring forth water from this rock? He was associating himself with this miraculous provision of water that God was about to perform, bringing water from a rock. And so he said, must we bring forth water from this rock? And so although we're told Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth, his pride rose up at that moment, and he said, must we bring forth water from this rock? And Daniel might have very well said, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, I'm bringing you this interpretation, and yes, I'm as powerful as the one in part who's making it known to you, because he's chosen to spoke through me, and I'm special. But you see Daniel's humility. And I think of a passage in 1 Peter chapter 5 that says, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, and significant in Daniel's case, he will exalt you in due measure. He will exalt you in due time. That's what we're going to find out happening to Daniel, that in due time, because of Daniel's humility, he is then exalted by King Nebuchadnezzar as this ordeal here comes to an end in Daniel chapter 2, and he provides the interpretation. Any other thoughts on verses 24 through 30? Miss Johnny? Okay. Right. Yep, and that's how Daniel, as he's writing this, records it. You remember Daniel was his Judean name, but Belshazzar was his Babylonian name. And Nebuchadnezzar speaking to him as the Babylonian king, and he's got here these men that he's sent through his training program, that he's trying to indoctrinate them with the Babylonian culture, and he speaks to Belshazzar, which is the name that he was given. So he does use Daniel's Babylonian name here in verse 26.
Daniel, when he was going to go into the king and told him that he would reveal it, that God had revealed it to him,
mm-hmm.
He did not know what the reaction of the king would be. You know, he had no idea. The king
right.
might have, you know, blew up and had him killed right there.
Nebuchadnezzar's already shown himself to be a pretty volatile
yeah.
character, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, blows up and says, kill all of the wise men. And so Daniel just, he was between a rock and a hard place, wasn't he? He could have kept quiet, or he was going to die, or he could have revealed this dream to Nebuchadnezzar, and it's not necessarily a terribly favorable outcome, but at the same time, that could have caused Nebuchadnezzar anger, and he could have blew up and had Daniel killed right there. So Daniel demonstrates a lot of faith here as he speaks out and says, I can provide this dream for God. Okay, let's continue on verses 31 through 35. Hey, Danny, do you mind reading for us chapter 2, verses 31 through 35?
Yeah.
Okay, so Daniel is describing to King Nebuchadnezzar here first the dream and the interpretation later that will follow. And he says, this image that's being described, this great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. So what Nebuchadnezzar had seen in his dream was this awesome, powerful image. And it obviously made an impact on him, on what he had seen. And Daniel then begins to describe the statue that was quite unique that Nebuchadnezzar had seen. He describes it as being made of four various materials, five rather, various materials. It's got four parts. It's got a head of fine gold, and it's got later a chest and arms of silver, a belly and thigh of bronze, legs of iron, and feet that are mixed with iron and clay. You know, and then what Nebuchadnezzar sees is he sees this stone being cut out, and there's not any hands involved. The stone's cut without hands, and it hits that statue that he sees, this great awesome statue, in the feet, and the statue crumbles and becomes like chaff that the wind drives away. So let's stop for just a moment. This is the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had that he's been waiting to hear told to him by the wise men. Consider the effect this dream had on him for just a moment. Some of these verses, looking back in the chapters, we see the impact of this dream on Nebuchadnezzar. We see that Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, or says he had dreams. His spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. So this dream caused him to lose his sleep, as it's described. And then the king, speaking to the wise men, he says, I've had a dream. My spirit is anxious to know the dream. So he's wanting to understand, what does this dream mean? He understands, and as you read through it, it's very significant. And he's trying to get an understanding of what this dream means. It's caused him to lose his sleep. And he says in verse 29, Daniel says in verse 29, you know, like after you had this dream and your spirit is anxious to know and you're not able to go back to sleep, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. So you see the impact that the dream had on Nebuchadnezzar. And after you see the dream and you read that, I think you can understand a little bit about why Nebuchadnezzar was so bothered by this dream. You know, a couple of things. You know, you've got here this great and awesome statue, which Nebuchadnezzar is probably going to associate with himself. We've seen his pride. We're going to see his pride later. So he sees this great statue, and in some way or another, he probably sees himself in affiliation with the statue. Then, however, the stone is made and is cut without hands, and it hits this statue, and this statue absolutely crumbles to dust. He sees himself probably in affiliation with that. And then he sees the statue coming to nothing, essentially. And so you can understand when you see here this dream, you can understand why King Nebuchadnezzar was so bothered by that. If he's that statue, or if that statue in some way indicates him and his kingdom or his people, and you see this stone being cut out and destroying it, what does that mean for his people? If he's wanting an interpretation, but you can see there why that bothered him so greatly. And so we've got here this statue that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream about, and it's kind of odd. You know, you think a little bit ahead to Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar's going to build a statue of his own. How is he going to build it? What's it made of? Remember the great image he builds? It's made of solid gold. You know, and that's what was odd, and that's what was different about the statue that he's dreaming about. You know, you want to build a great statue, you make it out of something very valuable. You make it out of gold. Well, you look at the statue that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about. Well, it's made of gold, yes, the head, but it's also made of silver and of bronze and of iron. And then at the very bottom, it's made of iron mixed with clay. So you've got here this strange amalgamation of materials being brought together to make this statue. And maybe that's why this dream kind of stood out. But you've got there the fine gold head. Daniel says it's made of fine gold, as he's telling the king. It's pure. It's unalloyed. There's no purities. There's nothing in there that would defile the gold. It's very valuable material. But then you go down to his torso, and you see a silver torso, obviously inferior in quality and price to gold. Still a very valuable material, no doubt. Oftentimes, silver was used for some of your coins, but it's significant because it's of less value than gold is. And then you look at the bronze, or the brass, that third portion, mixed from copper and metal. And bronze was primarily used for weapons and for tools. And as silver is of less value than gold, bronze is of less value than silver as well. But still, it possesses some value. And then the last part was made of iron. And this process of making iron wasn't discovered until about 1000 B.C. And so prior to the discovery of iron being made, or rather the removal of those base ores that leave you with iron, bronze or brass was the material that was used for weaponry and for tools and for things like that. But iron, however, was found to be superior when it came to weaponry, when it came to tools and things like that, as it was more durable, as it was harder. And you see this last part of the statue is made of iron. And then lastly, you know, the iron was mixed with clay. And so you've got there two materials that aren't going to mix very well. The iron and the clay aren't going to really adhere to one another. And we'll understand the significance of that as we continue on in the study. But the clear observation that we make is Nebuchadnezzar, we visualize this statue that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about. The clear conclusion of that is each material, as it changes, each part is inferior or is in lesser value to the previous. And so we'll examine the significance of the interpretation, because as the dream continues and Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel gives to Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of this dream, we see that he tells about the stone that's going to strike the statue. And this is perhaps the most significant or troublesome part of the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had. There's some features we want to consider regarding this account where the stone strikes the statue. The stone is an interesting character here in this dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, and no doubt is probably the most bothersome. So you consider this idea of the stone that comes and is cut without hands and it strikes the statue. Let's just note some of the unique characteristics that it possesses. And as we're going to see later in the interpretation, think about the stone in the context of what Nebuchadnezzar sees. So we see that this stone he sees in this dream was cut without hands, verse 35:4 tells us. What significance do you think that's going to possess? What might he have thought be involved in this stone that's cut without hands?
Some of the gods did.
Got him. If man's going to make a structure, then he's going to take and he's going to quarry out that stone and he's going to shape it to whatever it is he wants it to become. But he sees in this dream this great statue, then the stone is cut without hands. And so it seems to be pointing to something not man-made, but rather something that is somewhat divine in nature. It signifies divine origin. And then verse 34, as it continues, this stone comes out. You remember the statue is described as being great and awesome, and it's made an impression on King Nebuchadnezzar. But this stone that's cut out, it's rather small in its beginning, isn't it? It's not large, it's not impressive like the statue Nebuchadnezzar's dreaming about. And we understand that this is representative. The stone is representative of the kingdom of God. And then we'll understand, and we'll see later how the statue Nebuchadnezzar seen are the various kingdoms that are going to precede God's kingdom. But this stone is small in its beginning. It's not large and it's not impressive. You know, very seldom are the works of God at such in their inception. They're small in their beginning. Jesus tells the parable of the mustard seed. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. You know, it's smallest of all the seeds, but then it's planted, it grows, and it becomes a big tree. Birds are able to rest in its branches. So we see that although this stone is small in its beginning, we're not to judge a book by its cover. It's humble in its appearance. Unlike the statue, which was dazzling and made of these precious materials, the stone is rough and it's unrefined. And the indication being, you wouldn't want to judge the stone as it's going to, we're going to see it transform, and as we're going to see that it's wonderful in its growth, you don't judge that by its appearance. You see there the fact that the stone then grows into this huge mountain. Well, that's definitely unique, because stones and rocks don't grow. And so once again, we've got the divine nature of this stone manifested, because it grows into this great mountain. It appeared insignificant, but it grows into a great mountain. And what it's able to accomplish is mighty in its effects. You've got there this great statue that this stone strikes. It topples it over. And we're told that the stone then crushes all of the material, the statue, so that it becomes chaff, essentially, that the wind blows away. And then this stone grows into this great mountain. We see that in its duration, unlike that statue, which was standing there but clearly came to an end, it was demolished. This stone then grows into this great mountain. And there's no end described to this stone, this mountain. It stands forever, unlike that statue which was destroyed. You know, that's the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. I want to look at a few verses compare a couple to Daniel chapter 2, verse 35. As Daniel's speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, and he's describing the statue and the effect of this statue whenever the stone hits it. The iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, they were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. Psalm 1, verses 4 and 5, very almost parallel in the interpretation that Daniel gives to Nebuchadnezzar. And we're going to understand that this is judgment made on these four kingdoms. On what basis is this judgment made? On what basis are the kingdoms of man, the kingdoms of the earth, cast and crushed and then blown away like the chaff? You see there's a parallel. The psalmist is speaking of the ungodly. The ungodly are not so, but they're like the chaff which the wind drives away. And that's the same analogy that Daniel's using as he's describing this great statue. As King Nebuchadnezzar is perhaps wondering, is the dream going to be explained? Why is this judgment being made on my nation? You have there that idea of the threshing floor, and that's probably something we've heard in sermons before. Things that were brought in like grain were taken in this large flat floor, large flat room where they would be placed, and then they would have an ox with various implementation walking over back and forth to break the heads of grain loose from the stalk. Then they'd remove all the stalk. Then what they do is they take that grain that had broken loose and they toss it up in the air with a shovel on a windy day. And the chaff that was attached to that grain, just being so light, would just blow away and come to absolutely nothing. And the grain would then fall to the ground. And the comparison to King Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom and the following kingdoms is that they're going to be like the chaff. Well, on what basis are they going to be like the chaff? What's their flaw that's going to cause them to be so utterly and completely destroyed? I think the psalmist somewhat points to that. The ungodly are not so. It's the ungodly that are like the chaff that the wind's going to drive away. The ungodly shall not stand in judgment. And so this judgment that's going to be taking place on King Nebuchadnezzar and the following nations that arise after him isn't going to be on the basis of their might or their power, but they're like the chaff that the wind blows away because it's a moral judgment. It's a judgment based off of the fact of where they were morally, where they stood before God. And because they were ungodly, and because the ungodly can't stand in judgment, they're going to be blown away, they're going to be judged, and they're going to become just like the chaff that's blown away by the wind. And there's some, I believe, relevance in as we try to determine who is this stone? Who is this great stone that destroys this great statue and then grows into this big mountain? Psalm chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. This is a very messianic psalm, means that it's referring to Jesus. And speaking there to this king that God's going to place on the throne, he said, "Ask me, and I will give you the nations. I will give you the nations for your inheritance in the ends of the earth, for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel." So as we're taking all of God's word and we're trying to determine what is this great kingdom that God's going to establish, this passage here helps bring some clarity that we're talking here about a kingdom that is messianic in nature. It's the messianic kingdom of God that's represented by the stone, because you see that analogy, this iron taking and breaking these earthen vessels, you might say, is the analogy he uses. And that's kind of symbolic as to what we saw in the dream Nebuchadnezzar had. The statue comes, the statue's there, and the stone hits it, breaks it to pieces. And so you have the symbolism pointing toward what the stone is, and as Daniel's going to give later in his interpretation, the messianic kingdom of God. We've got about 6 minutes left. I'd like to cover just a little bit more. So, tell you what, we're going to skip reading verses 36 and 45. We'll pick that up, but there are some things I do briefly want to talk about. You may look at verse 36. When Daniel then, he's given the dream to Nebuchadnezzar, he's told him what dream he's had. He says, "This is a dream," verse 36. "Now we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king." So it's obvious Daniel's the one standing before the king, giving him this dream and giving him this interpretation. But he says to King Nebuchadnezzar, "We will give you the interpretation." So we may stop and say, well, who's the "we" there? Well, is it Daniel and his friends? Or is it Daniel and God? Or is it Daniel and God and his three friends? Or is it the we, Daniel, and perhaps angels. And the reason that some have suggested it might be angels involved with this, you turn over to chapter 7, 8, 9, later in the book, as Daniel's receiving interpretations for these various dreams, these angels are the ones that are coming and that are delivering to him the interpretation. And so some have looked at this and said, well, the we there is talking about Daniel and the angels. My best understanding, looking at Daniel and his character, he's definitely including God in the giving of this interpretation. But not only that, I believe he's speaking of his friends as well. The reason being, you look at the very last verse of the chapter, you see that not only was Daniel promoted, but both Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were promoted alongside Daniel. And you may remember their involvement in God giving Daniel this, the answer to this dream. They all went. They all prayed. They all petitioned God for the meaning of this dream to be given to them. And so they were all involved in that process. God then gives them the answer of the dream, and Daniel himself goes and makes the dream known. So in verse 36, as Daniel says, we're going to make known to you the meaning of the dream. I believe he's talking, or he's including his friends, and also he's including God, of course, as he's pointed away from himself and pointed to God. I'd like to speak in the last part of our class here about the degrading greatness of the statue, because that's one of the observations that is easy for us to make. And it's kind of neat when you look into this. Yep. In what way, and we're going to consider the four empires, the golden head being the Babylonian, the silver arms and chest being the Medo-Persian, and on the other, we had that broken down for us, the bronze being the Greek, and then the iron being the Roman Empire. We see this degrading greatness of the statue, but I want to kind of point out with those various nations as they rose and as they fell, how that degrading took place. One of the ways, I think it's quite obvious, you consider the degrading greatness of the statue. One of the ways that you see this degrading taking place is you see the power of the monarch and the unity of the empire degrading as you go from Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Grecian, Roman. Let me tell you a little bit about what I mean. Nebuchadnezzar ruled with absolute, unquestionable authority. Go look at Daniel chapter 5, verses, I thought I had that on the screen. Turn over to Daniel 5, just a couple chapters, and look at verses 18 and 19 as Nebuchadnezzar is being referred to here. And Daniel, as he's speaking to King Nebuchadnezzar, or rather as he's speaking, I believe, to Belshazzar, speaking about Nebuchadnezzar, he says, O King, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and all feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up, and whomever he wished, he put down. So Daniel, speaking about Nebuchadnezzar, essentially said Nebuchadnezzar killed whoever he wanted, and he kept alive whoever he wanted. Nebuchadnezzar's reign within the Babylonian Empire was absolutely unquestioned. Now, you consider the next nation that arose after the Babylonians fell. That was the Medo-Persians. They represented the silver arms and torso. Well, the Medo-Persian ruler, the king, did not possess that same authority that Nebuchadnezzar did to kill or to keep alive, which was absolutely unquestioned. Now, you think of the book of Esther, and you've got King Ahasuerus is there, and he's surrounded by these advisors. They help keep him in check. They help advise him in regard to certain things. Or you may remember later in the book of Daniel, chapter 6, wherever the king makes this decree, Darius makes this decree that whoever was found worshiping any other god aside from the king would be cast into a lion's den. He finds out his buddy Daniel was guilty of that. He wanted to save Daniel, didn't he? But he couldn't. Remember, the wise man come to him and said, you know, King, you put this decree in place. Once this decree is in place, you know, this system of checks and balances prevents you from overthrowing this decree that was made. And despite the fact that Darius wanted to save Daniel, he had to send him to the lion's den. So you see, he has less power. Nebuchadnezzar would have said, no, you're going to die. We're going to throw you in a lion's den, and Daniel's going to be saved. If he didn't want to do that, he had the power to do that. So you see that loss of power that the monarch has as you go from the Babylonian to the Medo-Persian. But then you go to the next kingdom, that which is the Greek. You've got Alexander the Great, who ruled and he built this great empire. After his death, though, You see the power of the monarch fading. You see the unity of the empire fading. After Alexander the Great, who brought the Greeks to greatness, after he died, the kingdom was divided into four separate parts. So that which was once unified was made, and there was infighting, and there was corruption, and there were those sorts of things among the leaders and the rulers of the Grecian Empire. And then lastly, you look at the Romans, which were representative of the iron and clay. Corruption and division was what brought about the downfall of the Roman nation. And so you see that degrading power of the monarch as you work your way down through those various nations and those various empires, and you see the degradation of the unity that the nations possessed, each one being less great than the other. So it looks like we're out of time. There is one more point that we wanted to make, and we'll pick up here next week. As you see the degrading value and greatness of the statue, next week we'll look at the ascendance to the throne. That is, how the leader got into this position of power. And this is why we see the degrading value of this material and of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar seen, which represented the empire.